Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for June 21st, 2018. Tonight I'll be talking a little bit about Venus, about earthquakes, lightning associated with earthquakes, and a note about Dr. Mercola, not sure what's going on there, some notices about GE, General Electric, one of the oldest high-tech companies in the country, and in a sense, possibly in the world, and a few other topics. Now, last week, I said that this week I would have a guest, Robert Schuller, on my show, and all we had were technical difficulties. I hate to say this, but it's like somebody really didn't want me to interview him. I almost get that impression because we had many appointments, and in fact, I was going to have him on last week's show, but we had technical difficulties. My Skype wouldn't work. The recording software would not work. It wouldn't record. I mean, just everything did not work. And so, anyway, I was not able to have him. So I don't know when I'll be able to get this fixed. But I'll just mention a few things. First of all, he was a student at Cornell, and I talked to him a number of times, and he quit. He quit as a student, and he just said he just realized he did not fit there. And Cornell is a very strange place. When I was there, I had a lot of friends, a lot of student friends, great students, just regular people. But there's some really high, edgy people there, too. They come from families that are high-end. I mean, to get into Cornell, you need, you know, stellar, all your tests, your scores, and then some. It's very difficult to get in, and then, of course, costs a lot of money. But he quit. And he quit because of a course he was taking dealing with GMO. It was a course about GMO, and he realized that, hey, this is just an advertisement for Monsanto. And I've talked to him a number of times since, and he became a bit disillusioned, as I did in working there. And quite frankly, I would have stayed working there if I could have. But my life took a different turn, and it's one of those turns, those you come to a Y in the road, and it either you make a choice or the choice is made for you, as was the case with me. And in his case, he made the choice to leave, and then he became very vocal about Monsanto owning a piece of Cornell, and that's the case. Unfortunately, and in the meantime, somebody sent me a link to the following book. It's called Monsters of the Ivy League. Monsters of the Ivy League by Steve Radlauer. And you can find that on Amazon, Monsters of the Ivy League. And what it talks about is the fact that, of course, there's a lot of high-end people that come out of the school, and including the Ivy Leagues, not just Cornell, but the other, I think there's 9 total, Harvard, Cornell, Yale, etc. And, of course, each one of those schools has a sister school. And those schools were started now, of course, Cornell was co-ed, but the Ivy League schools were typically all male, and then the sister schools were all female. And in fact, where I went to college, there was a similar situation. When I started college, it was all male college, and there was a sister school in the same town, not really economically associated, but it's just that sometimes that's the way it works out, because if you have an all male school, it behooves you. It's just good business sense, I guess, to have an all-girls school, because then all the girls want to go there. They get a good private education. And then also, in that case, they were Catholic school, St. Mary's College and St. Teresa's. But the Ivy League schools, of course, were not religious, associated with a religion, but were independent private schools. But the point is that these have always been very high-end schools. But in the mix, and whenever you have something like this, it gets taken over. And power groups get in there, and as they get a hold in a department, or in, like in the case of Cornell, the pecking order started with Carl Sagan. Everybody had to march to his tune when you were there, and of course, I didn't. I didn't march to any of their tunes. I marched to my own tune and published papers that was, you know, very much in their face. But anyway, back to Robert Schuller. He, so I talked to him quite a bit as we were, you know, discussing, you know, what happened to him, what happened to me. And the book, this is one thing, one of the reasons I mentioned this book, Monsters of the Ivy League, is because in his preface talking about the book, on, you can find it, that book on Amazon, he says that if you are a student at an Ivy League school, and after a while you start to look around and you go, what the heck am I doing here? Well, you're in good company, because that's probably what you should be thinking. What did I get myself into? And a lot of high pressure from families, from just the, you know, if you get in there, now not everybody does well once they get to Cornell. So you're dealing with people who got probably straight A's from the time they were in kindergarten. And I had people like that in the college where I was, and they were very hard to be around, very, very high end. When test time came or something like that, these people went psycho. And but anyway, there's also an issue at Cornell. It's was a suicide issue. There was a very high rate of student suicide. And one day, for example, it's not something that was published or talked about, but it was there. And it didn't dawn on me until after I was there for a while that this was going on, this high suicide rate at the school. So anyway, one day I'm walking out of campus, walking down to the little college town down below campus. And as you do, there's a bridge there. There's a bridge and a very, very deep gorge with a little river running down through it. And you have to cross this bridge to get down into the college town associated with Cornell in Ithaca. And so I'm walking down there, the beautiful spring, sunny day. And as I come and I'm approaching the bridge, I might be 100 feet away, I notice a group of students, and they're kind of standing away from one of the sides of the bridge. This is an all rock, cement rock bridge. And sitting on the very edge of the bridge at the precipice over the gorge is a student, a male student. And he's sitting on the very edge, and he's got his hands like he's ready to push off. And I'm going, oh no, oh no. And the students are yelling at him, no, don't do this. And he's yelling at the students, don't come near me. And so, of course, they're not going to, thinking that they would force him to jump. And this went on. I stopped. Of course, at that point, I just froze. And I'm watching this, you know, not knowing what to do. And all of a sudden, the student just pushed off and disappeared. And as soon as that happens, you know that he's dead, because nobody could survive that fall. You know, in that instant, a life was lost and a person went over the edge. And this happened all the time at Cornell. And so then I became more aware of this. And I, anyway, it's a very tough school to be around, and it's very tough to be around the faculty, many of whom are very high-end in terms of their nose up in the sky. I mean, it's very difficult to talk to them, especially in the sciences and especially in physics, astrophysics, space science, and astronomy, which I dealt with. The math people there were very laid back, very good mathematicians, and I got along fabulously well with the mathematicians. They were very laid back, very easygoing. Dr. Wolfgang Fuchs, the head of the math department when I was there, was very friendly with me all the time, except at the very end he called me into the office where he told me that the astronomy department was putting pressure on him to fire me because they didn't want me publishing my papers anymore. Because at that time I was publishing my papers, James J.M. McCanney, Department of Mathematics, Cornell University. And he told me, he said, I was the only person in the history of the math department at Cornell who was published in an astrophysics, peer-reviewed astrophysics journals. And that said a couple things to me. First of all, that was pretty remarkable accomplishment. And second of all, that just shows you the pecking order that these people probably could have published mathematical treatises on astronomy or astrophysics or relativity, or which is tensor analysis, which is all mathematics, but none of them ever did. And it was like that was a zone that they just didn't go into. So anyway, but yeah, being at Cornell was an experience and a half. But you also experience the influence. Now, this is what I'm getting at. The influence on campus of big business. You also get the impression that students go there with a gee whiz attitude, and anything they're told by faculty at that school, they just take it hook, line, and sinker, like it's got to be gospel truth, and they take it and run. Now, in my preparation for interviewing Robert, I took a look at the Cornell homepage. And for example, one of the projects that was elucidated on the Cornell homepage was installing smart meters all around the region, the town, Ithaca, in that region, and in the county with the local electric company. And they had somewhat of an outreach program to educate the public on how they could benefit by watching their electrical use. But it said nothing about the commonly understood problems with smart meters, that basically you have a monitor in your house that monitors everything you do and everything your family does and everything they say. It's basically Big Brother in your house. But this, herein lies the problem with a place like Cornell or many other universities, higher seats of learning where students go and in a lot of cases are fooled and are drawn into this with rosy-colored glasses, a term I've used a few times recently. And, here's the problem. Students come out of high school and they go to college, you know, and it's a great time. I was there. I think I spent college very differently than most people. When I got to college, I said, okay, I'm going to break down everything I was taught and I'm going to put it back together again my way. And I'm going to take some time in doing this. And I don't think many students do that. They just go off. And my estimation of college, being both a student, having a lot of friends who are in college, and then being in a lot of college campus settings and having lots of friends who went to different colleges, all kinds of different college settings, and then being basically on the teacher side of university life for about 10 years of my life, and then also knowing a lot of people that have come out of that and grown up, and I see them in the world in all capacities. And my estimation of college is that it is advanced babysitting. And really, that's but Cornell is a special case, or the Ivy League schools. It's a place where people come out of, and I see this a lot of times also in government. And this guy that's talking about the book that I just mentioned, The Monsters of the Ivy League, that these people come out of there with a attitude, and you see it in government. You see it, for example, I talked before about Rhodes Scholars, where these people are singled out and taken over to that special university in England, where they're groomed. They're groomed to become world leaders. And remember that Cecil Rhodes, who began the Rhodes Scholar Program, his goal is to destroy the United States and bring it back into the fold of the English Empire. Literally, that's the goal. And so you can see people like the people in government, Rice and Bill Clinton, and just a long list of other people, about 7,000 people in the United States who are Rhodes Scholars and in high positions throughout the world. And they know one thing, is that they will not be called on the carpet if they break laws. It seems like whatever they do, they're immune, and they know this. They're probably taught this because it's actually true. You can actually see it working in the real world. And this is a classic statement that came from Bill Clinton. Just recently, he was interviewed, and they were talking about the old days of the abuse of women when he was president and going back into Arkansas. And his comment was, says, well, things have changed. That this is a Bill Clinton statement. Oh, things have changed. It's much harder now to abuse people or make them do things that they don't want to do. I thought, my goodness, what planet are these people living in on? I mean, what do you mean that it's much more difficult today to make people do what they don't want to do? And, you know, and maybe in a sense, he's right in that it used to be a lot easier just to take kids, send them off to war. Now people are thinking about it. Whereas, you know, and that started happening in the Vietnam War. But anyway, that's another topic. But the attitude that these people have is my point. When I was at Cornell, every day I would go up to the Space Science Building, and there were meetings where the data was coming in, and there would be 2-3 meetings in an afternoon. It was fairly intensive. Some might be on astrophysics, some might be on space science, the NASA stuff that was there. It was a NASA repository of data, and many NASA space science scientists were in residence there. But the arrogance is what I want to talk about now. It's the absolute feeling of anything they say had to be true. I remember a guy named Joe Vavirka, especially, and there were other ones too, who were extremely arrogant. And they would stand there and they would like, and Carl Sagan was the epitome of the head slightly back. I don't have time for your silliness. You know, you just listen to us. We have the answers. And don't question anything because we're smart and you're dumb. And that's just the way it is. Don't expect to think about things. Just take our word for we figured it all out. You don't have to think about it because we have the answers. We will give you all of the answers. Okay, so enough of that. But anyway, I will hopefully have this interview with Robert Schuller next week or in a week coming up here. And just a quick comment also. This especially happens on these pages that deal with so-called science or glossy science, where they take a snippet of science and make it into this glossy article that really doesn't tell you anything, just kind of paints that broad brush of standard science. But at the bottom, there's a lot of clickbait. You know, click here to see the, you know, the 10 best places in the world to vacation or something. And one of them that I keep seeing is commenting on Melania Trump's IQ. And that may, as you can tell in the, I've never clicked on it. I don't click on clickbait. But you could tell that they're going to make fun of her and somehow slash her because of her alleged IQ rating. I'm not sure where they get this, but first of all, it's really disgusting to make fun of people based on your opinion if they're smart or dumb. But also, I've never, ever believed in IQ tests. And I could run around and tout that, you know, something, I'm sure. If I ever had an IQ test, I'm sure I didn't and never would take one because I don't believe in that. Because IQ tests are designed for certain people, like, say, Mensa or something like that. Or even standardized tests where you can groom yourself to do better. Does that mean you have a higher IQ? I don't think so. And everybody, to my way of seeing it, has a superior IQ. There are people that have superior IQ from me in, say, music. There are a lot of musicians who never took a music lesson. Wonderful musicians creating absolutely marvelous music that everybody loves. But, and they have an aptitude for that, so they have an IQ, but they probably would have a real hard time, say, possibly understanding my prime number work. You know, so everybody has their talent. And I know people, too, that allegedly had low IQs. And really, when I worked with, this is a great example. I did some volunteer teaching one time in an inner city just to help people out with mathematics. And I came in and was in a grade school setting. They were like kids maybe 10 years old, maybe something like that. And these two little twins, boys, had been abused by their father. And the father told them, you're not going to study. You're going to be boxers. And he wanted his kids to be tough little boxers. And literally, you know, like professional boxers. And so anyway, I said my job was to sit down, you know, volunteering. They said, go work with these two kids. They cannot do mathematics. And I said, okay, this is interesting. So I sat down and I said, okay, show me what you know about mathematics. And we were just going to add and multiply some numbers. And so they started writing and the numbers were kind of all over the page. And, you know, and they couldn't figure out how this one multiplied by that one. And before it was done, it was just a big mess. And so I realized that they didn't know how to order the numbers or organize them in rows and columns. And so I drew like a tic-tac-toe type of grid for them to put the numbers in. And I said, now this one here, and I showed them the order, how you add numbers and columns or you multiply this number, this first one on the second line by the first one on the top line, and you write your result down in here, and then you carry over the number and you put it up in this little box here. And by doing that, in a couple, maybe 15, 20 minutes, I had them adding and subtracting numbers. And so with these kids, if they would have taken an IQ test, they would have probably failed miserably because they simply weren't organized. They didn't understand organization. And I have to say something, too, about myself. In first grade, it took me a long time before I could read. And it was because nobody ever told me. They were, like, pointing to the book and saying things. And I'm going, like, I don't know what they're doing. Nobody had ever told me that the words indicated that were written indicated words that were you would have learned probably already. And I didn't associate that. You know, it just wasn't something that was immediately obvious to me. So then I learned how to read. And I said, okay, this word means that, this word means this, and you put them together. And it was an organizational thing. And so anyway, then I learned how to read. And of course, the rest of my life, I learned how to read. So what I learned about mathematics and teaching mathematics is that too many times, people lost the chain of information from adding to multiplying to, you know, advanced mathematics. Somewhere in there, they lost it. They didn't, and mathematics is something where you have to do every step, and then you go to the next higher level and the next higher level, and it all builds. So if you somehow are missing a fundamental step in there somewhere, then you are going to simply be bad at math. And I spent a bit of time myself tutoring. When I was at Tulane, I earned extra money by tutoring. And also when I lived in Mexico, I taught the kids of the very rich people there, the very wealthy people. And so I realized that most people don't, you know, they're not good at math or physics, etc. It's simply because they haven't been trained properly. And when I was at Tulane, I tutored the Tulane football team, the Green Wave, and got them. I had the linemen getting A's. All of them were getting A's in physics. In fact, it was so unusual that both the coach called me in and the professor of the physics class, and he wanted to know what I was doing that these people were all getting A's. And the coach of the football team is like, what are you doing? We can't have cheating here. I said, I'm teaching them how to do physics. How could you teach linemen of a football team who really are not adept at those type of things? How could you get them so they're all getting A's in physics? So I said, I'm teaching them how to do physics. And the professor of the class was very irritated because all his great teaching did not accomplish that. And I could. And of course, the professor ultimately knew that he was creating the tests and I had no access to his tests. So how could I was simply teaching them how to do physics. And it's very simple if you teach people and give them in an organized fashion. So anyway, back to Melania Trump, who's getting a tremendous amount of flack from the crooked news media, but to start implying that somehow she has a low IQ is disgusting, just absolutely disgusting. So anyway, and I don't think anybody has a low IQ. I mean, there's people that maybe have physical deficiencies. That's another issue. There are certain politicians in the past that I would claim had a rather average to low IQ. But there again, that's because they didn't develop themselves. They grew up in a, you know, in a endowed upbringing and didn't have to do much. So anyway. So I'm going to go through a bunch of other topics quickly here. Quickly on illegal immigration, all of that's going on in Congress. I hope they solve this problem. But the statistics are very clear that there's this big issue about breaking up families and taking kids away from families. They even got the Pope weighing in on this. Well, I'm sorry, the Pope isn't down at the border. And the Pope should be the last guy on the planet talking about illegal immigration. At the Vatican, they have 100% no immigrant policy. You cannot, even though it's an independent country and considered as an independent country, they don't allow any immigrants in. So the Pope is the last dude on the planet that should be somehow lecturing anybody on immigration policy. But the reality is this issue of breaking up families, the vast majority statistic, these are statistics, the vast majority of kids that come across the border with adults are not families. They're kids who are kidnapped. They're in the human trafficking rings, and that's what's going on. So they're taking these kids away, which is saving them from a life of living hell. And so don't listen to people who are telling you that they're taking the families away, the breaking up families and taking kids away from their family. This is something that is horrendous. And for people to play on this and then somehow blame it on Trump, you know, is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And the issue with illegal immigration, you can have your opinion whether you like immigration or not. Try to do this. Okay, do this if you're pro-immigration open borders. You go down to the Mexican border and cross into Mexico and say, I want welfare. I want you to just give me something to live on, provide me with a place, etc. Go down there and see how far you get. They're going to laugh you back across the bridge, and that's going to be the end of it. Okay, so it is so absurd, the way people twist these stories. Anyway, that's enough of that. But I lived in Mexico. I know the Mexican people. I know Mexican people in the United States, both illegal and legal. I know people from Cuba, Venezuela, all the other Latin American countries. And there's a big problem. It's a huge problem. But the end result is that it's much less expensive and much more equitable to take care of those people in their own country, where you can live for a year in a South American country very nicely on $1,000. You know, that goes up in smoke in a day in the United States for care centers, etc. So I wish that Trump, this is my wish, if somebody knows him, point him in my direction, that I would have the Latin American problem solved in about a couple days. And I could do it because I know the people. I know what their wants and desires are. I speak the language. I have taught students. I know all of the social problems that they deal with. I've lived with the poorest people. I've traveled all around these countries. And I could literally solve, this includes the Cuba, the Venezuela problems, the other problems in Latin America, in Mexico. I could have the illegal immigration problem. I could have these solved in an afternoon, very simply. But nobody has knocked on my door. And they keep battling these age-old policies, which caused all of the situations we're seeing today. So anyway, enough of that. There's been a big push recently to take away Obama's Nobel Peace Prize. And I'm a person who's very much in favor of that. But the Nobel Prize 10 years ago started to become very politicized. They gave NASA a Nobel Prize in physics for the work with the COBE project, which looked at the microwave background radiation. Terribly politicized. It broke all of the rules. It was given to a group who was government funded. None of those things should have ever happened under the Nobel rules. But anyway, I would be 100% in favor of Obama being stripped of his Nobel Peace Prize. And even the people on the committee who gave the prize are very remiss now about that. China, I announced this before, but this is becoming a bigger story than before. China has stopped the subsidies on solar panels, which was to the tune of about 40%. And so companies like First Solar, their stock prices just plunged when The day that China made that announcement, they went from $75 down to $48 stock price in one day. But China realized that solar panels are not going to solve their problem because the sun only shines a certain amount of time per day. And to build enough solar panels then that you would put in some kind of a storage facility, electrical storage or mechanical storage or high pressure gas storage or whatever, that's very expensive technology. And even though the price of batteries is coming down to power China, it's not going to be done by solar. And I realized this a long time ago. I even made an analysis that if you made a solar panel that was 100% efficient and cost, let's say, a penny a solar panel, it still could not be cost effective and it would not replace the central power company. So that's what the Chinese have figured out, is that you cannot shut down a central power plant that's coal-fired or natural gas-fired. You cannot shut that plant down for a few hours and then all of a sudden crank it up to full power. It actually takes more power to get the turbines running, etc., in a coal-fired or natural gas or nuclear plant. It actually takes more energy. It's kind of like companies, you'll see them, they'll leave the lights on all night long. And the reason is because it takes more energy to turn the light on than it does simply to run the light for more period of time. And it also, that surge tends to burn the lights out. So overall, it's more expensive to turn things on and off electrically, and especially a power plant. You simply cannot turn it on for the, you know, the time when the sun is not shining and then quickly turn it off when the sun pops out, decides to shine. So the Chinese finally figured this out. And in a day, they just said no more, because China was putting in vast amounts of solar panels. And they just came to the conclusion, boom. And it was not a financial issue. It had nothing to do with Trump tariffs. None of this, these were the issues. They just realized that solar doesn't work. Something that I've been telling you all along. And just a quick mention that the excessive use of energy, that 80% of energy from high energy content fuels goes up, 80% of it goes up as heat. And so that's something I keep barking about. Just a quick notice, Monsanto being purchased by Bayer is being approved. It's don't buy any more Bayer products. That's my advice. Take Bayer and shut it down. Forget it. They will buy a company like Monsanto, and Dow and DuPont Chemical are joining. They're being allowed to join, which this should never happen, because these are already monopolies. Their anti-trade, antitrust should not allow this to happen, but they're allowing it to happen. So as of today, there are three giant seed companies in the world. Bayer, there's a chem company out of China, which is a conglomerate of previously owned seed companies, and then Dow and DuPont joining to form one company. And I don't know offhand how they're going to name the new company, but 70% of the world's seeds come from three companies that are all GMO. So, and this was the complaint also, Robert Schuller, the guy I was going to interview, who is a student at Cornell, his complaint was that Cornell was bought and paid for by Monsanto, the research that's going on at Cornell University in agriculture, etc. So, anyway, another big story breaking this week, lightning with earthquakes. Now, this has been going on for a long time. I'll preface this by saying that when I was in Ecuador, a number of years ago, probably 2 years ago now, and running, I was in the major earthquakes in Ecuador, And I got slammed around. I think I've told that story on the air. I was in a shower in a building taking a shower full of soap. And all of a sudden an earthquake hit, and I am being slammed against the side of the shower as this earthquake is shaking. The lights go out, so it's pitch black. And so I managed to get out, and I managed to grab a towel as I ran. And there were tables and chairs and things in the room I had to get through to get to the door to get out of this building. And I go out into the street, and of course, in an earthquake, if you've ever been in one or seen a video of one, everybody is screaming. Everybody is screaming. And it's just pandemonium, because the ground under you, the buildings under you, are about to come toppling down. But anyway, along with that, as I got outside, and I was in many earthquakes and aftershocks, and I mean, we couldn't sleep at night. Everybody, you know, you'd just be waiting. And as soon as that first shake started, you know, you were to the door. You had to get out of that building because it could come toppling down on you. And so for quite a while, it was like many sleepless nights, believe me. But anyway, I went outside and I looked down along the coastline, which was about probably 4 miles away. I could see clearly the ocean and the coastline and lightning, this like strange lightning. It wasn't like lightning bolts. It was atmospheric lightning, like heat lightning. And very clearly, because this was at night and all the lights are out, and I could see the lightning lighting up the whole countryside, basically. Okay, so anyway, in London, Japan, Ecuador, there's now with the earthquakes in Hawaii, there's these videos coming in. Associated with noise, trumpeting sounds and grinding sounds, metal on metal sounds. And this is what the ancients talk about in the Colbran and in other ancient books. They talk about the trumpeting sounds that are associated with atmospheric electricity and other phenomena. And so anyway, the issue is that I just wanted to bring this out. Also in Michigan, and there was a light beam that was recorded in Michigan. So anyway, the belief of some people, and I believe this too myself, although... and I know in the case of Ecuador, I reported on the Rods from God issue where they sent in nuclear-tipped, basically the Rods from Gods are like an arrow, a metal arrow that comes in from an outer space weapon. And the first major Ecuadorian earthquake was man-made. The other issue was that it went off, one of them went off prematurely. In other words, it didn't burrow down far enough into the ground, and that caused a lot of radiation sickness in a region which I described in my previous lectures in Ecuador. And so, at any rate, it does appear that some of this is man-made. But in this mix, now, there have been warnings going out in certain countries like Sweden and telling the people to become prepared. So I'm not sure where all of this is going or coming from. Sweden, I meant. That they're talking about June 10th, a massive event. Well, of course, June 10th has come and gone. But at any rate, we'll see. General Electric has been dumped by the Dow Jones. Now, General Electric was started in the late 1800s by Thomas Edison. This is General Electric is probably one of the oldest big conglomerate high-tech companies to exist in the history of the world. They made nuclear submarines. They made parts. Their big core business is the parts for power plants, electrical central power plants, light bulbs, I mean, you name it, General Electric makes it, toasters, refrigerators, all kinds of machinery, motors, whatever. So anyway, they have not been doing well recently. And so they actually got removed from the Dow Jones listing because they were dragging down the Dow Jones average, and they were replaced by Walgreens, like some branch of Walgreens, which is strange. But anyway, their stocks are down 60%. So, and of course, I have a problem with General Electric because they produce the non-working three-blade wind generators, which have sucked up all of the alternative energy money subsidies, ridden the government subsidies. But of course, that's a small piece of their business, just like, say, Siemens out of Germany is, you might say, is the equivalent of General Electric in Germany. And Siemens and General Electric are right now being, I don't know what state it's in, but they, what condition the lawsuit is in, but the government of Germany suing General Electric and Siemens for colluding or bribery, basically, through the Clinton Foundation, bribing the German government officials to put in their three-blade wind generators in Germany. And this has been going on all over the world. And that's one thing I could never figure out is how these countries were getting these wind generator installations and how the word was not spreading that, hey, these things don't work. So anyway, General Electric is having problems. A quick announcement. Trump Space Force, he's pushing this through, pros and cons. Let me tell you about the pros. If you're going to be strong militarily, then it would behoove you to become strong in outer space. But the problem is that a long time ago, countries signed an agreement not to militarize outer space. So it's like if one person does it, everybody else is going to do it. In my book, The Diamond Principle, I discuss the difficulty of militarizing outer space. It's very different than anything that's happened before. Simple reason, space is three-dimensional. All wars previously, unless you count the ocean and the air, is three-dimensional, but it's very limited three-dimensional. It's still around the surface of the Earth, even if you look at outer space in low Earth orbit, 100 miles up. The Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter, and so if on a global scale, if you picked up a globe in your hand, a model of the Earth, and you held it in your hands, the atmosphere would be about as thick as a piece of paper, and or maybe two or three sheets of paper thickness. But it's very small. The atmosphere of Earth is it's very small, at least the thick part of the atmosphere, and then the same with the ocean. So literally, we are a two-dimensional being. We're living on a two-dimensional surface of planet Earth. And so when militarism expanded, when empire building expanded, any time in the past, it was in two dimensions. And we find places like the Roman Empire, which got so big and they got so spread out that they really didn't even know what was going on. Their armies were out there just ravaging and pillaging at the far edges of the realm at that time. They were working their way up into the Black Forest, but they couldn't penetrate the Black Forest. They had a hard time penetrating England. They finally conquered England and left their Roman language there, which became English. And, of course, the Celts were instrumental, too. They go way back in the Mediterranean region. Eventually, the remnants of the Celts became the residents of Wales and other small portions of Ireland, and then, of course, the Nordic countries, where the my ancestors were literally from the Nordic countries that settled from the north, settled Ireland in the 800 AD time frame. So anyway, the point is that warfare in the past has been a two-dimensional effort. When you start going three-dimensional and you say, we're going to protect this area, it's a different story. And that's the problem with going militarizing the region of outer space. Because you can have a space station over here or over there or something like that. And if people can move in three dimensions, then you're not going to be able to cover and protect and defend all of those areas in three dimensions. In fact, I make a clear point in my book, The Diamond Principle, that if a person invests in simply outer space technology and moving out into outer space, that by that militarism is really a burden on the country that instills militarism, and the other country, which does not require protection of the protection racket of some kind. But also you can see that this is being supported by the aerospace industries. It's going to be a big money maker to protect outer space. So, but the country, say China, or say Russia, says, hey, we're going to go out into space. We're not going to bring all our military along with us. And they'll go out the farthest and the fastest, because by the time you build all your military equipment to guard what you've already accumulated in three-dimensional outer space, then you're going to be way behind the curve, because these other civilizations that have not burdened themselves with militarism in outer space in three dimensions are going to go much farther and much faster, and you're not even going to be able to catch up to them to use your military, let alone, you know, catch them. So at any rate, bad idea. That's my estimation. Just a quick note, Canada and Mexico are legalizing marijuana. And what does that have to do with the United States? Well, it has a lot to do with it, because the market is going to be, there's certain states, I believe the state of Hawaii, and I don't know what other states have legalized growing for medical purposes under controlled raising crops, etc. And then also hemp, which is not marijuana. And that is pretty much confirmed. But there's so many uses, both nutritive and from products like fiber, etc., that come from hemp. But anyway, it's going to force the United States and Great Britain to change their policies and also legalize, because it's a financial issue. I think it's going to come much sooner this way. But just the other day, Canada legalizing marijuana. And so anyway, in terms of the drug, my personal opinion is, in my particular body, I don't want anything that disrupts my brain activity, because I'm at peak performance mentally, and I want to stay that way. I want to stay, and so I don't want to put anything. I don't smoke cigarettes. I would not use any type of mind-altering or nervous system-altering drugs, or plant materials, whatever, because I want to stay at peak performance. I'm busy every day with the wing generator project, with the XPRIZE that's going on, with everything else that I do, my other work in the background. I'm just really busy, and so I want to keep myself very much on the cutting edge and able to do everything that I do, and make correct decisions and not be. But the reality is that those changes are coming along. Just a quick note on another topic. This past week, another $30 million equivalent value in cryptocurrencies were stolen out of the Korean market. And these events of theft are becoming more and more common. There have been cryptocurrency companies, mining companies, that have gone out of business because, and then also there are not only the mining companies, but the central exchange companies that are the holding, they're the central computer system that holds the cryptocurrencies. And I predicted this. I was on a show called Cryptocurrency, and that was one of the things I said, that and one of the hosts was very emphatic, asking me questions and saying, "Do you mean cryptocurrencies are not secure?" And I said, "No. I said a lot of them use the RSA encryption codes, and those are very easily broken in terms of security, cybersecurity. And so, isn't it any big surprise that the cryptocurrencies are being broken into and stolen in large quantities?" Now, it would be like stolen cash. How do you spend it? How do you convince somebody that you all of a sudden have $30 million in cryptocurrency and then you try to start spending it? I would think it'd be very easy to spot somebody like the old case of the drug dealer. This poor kid that lives down the block all of a sudden starts driving Cadillacs and, taking expensive trips. It's like, wait a minute, where does this guy get all his money? And so, but anyway, this is happening, which just, it was a point that I made a long time ago, that cryptocurrencies' security are not safe. So anyway, that's been going on. It's going to continue to go on. And in a fast-moving technological world like cryptocurrencies, a lot of times people move forward without taking the proper security precautions. And that's what's going on. That's something that I actually could work in. I could do a lot of good in that world of computer security, but I'm so busy doing my other work, crypto computer security, is something I worked in for 25 years of my life. And also I broke the RSA codes by solving the prime number problem. My book, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, elucidates how to break those codes very easily. A child can do it with a laptop computer. So anyway, boy, this show, I don't know where it went, but I'm out of time. Just to remind you, my webpage, jmccsci.com, the water filter sales, the paid cast. Right now in the paid cast, I'm giving lectures on the book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, dealing with propulsion systems and infinite or unlimited electrical power. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.